So here's our speaker, Bradley Cool.
Okay, I'll mention, in case people have to leave, I don't mind if you have to leave, just leave, okay? I don't expect everybody to sit through the entire talk if they don't want to. There's a number of things you can take on the table there. Michael already mentioned the stickers. There's also buttons that you're welcome to take, and various literature items. However, I encourage you not to take the CDs, because they're all proprietary software. Apparently IBM is giving them out, but I encourage you not to take them, unless you need a coaster, in which case you should certainly take it and use it as a coaster. Or if you have CD recycling in your home, maybe take them and recycle them. But I hope you won't use them and put them in your computer. And I'll talk more about that as in the talk. See, most people, when they talk about free software, they focus on how it's more reliable, more sensible, more dependable software. And to some extent, I don't need to tell you that, because there's so many people talking about that, particularly in the late 1990s. There was a lot of press about that aspect of our community. And it's, of course, important to make sure that our software is reliable. Since more and more people depend on computers, they should have reliable and dependable systems to use. But I think there's reasons to choose free software that have nothing to do with the quality of the software or how reliable it is. In fact, I think that technology is ultimately a secondary issue. And I focus on the idea of augmenting community and fostering cooperation and goodwill among users and programmers of computer software. What I hope to do tonight is demonstrate, through a number of personal anecdotes, some ethical consideration, and some historical perspective, about how free software can build and create these kinds of cooperating communities, and how, by direct contrast, proprietary software tears down communities and impedes people from cooperating with each other. The first thing that I always do in a talk is I define free software. And they always tell you when you give talks you shouldn't start it by giving definitions, but I'm forced to do this because English has a bug in it. We have more words than any other language on the planet, but we only have one adjective, free, with a number of different meanings. And there's a key difference between two of those meanings that cause a common confusion. When you say something is free, you can either mean that it is free as in freedom, like in free speech, or free as in price, like in free beer. When we're talking about free software, we're talking about free speech, not free beer. We're talking about the aspect of freedom that you get with the software. You see, with free software, the issue of paying is not central. Most people do get free software at low or zero cost. But that low cost aspect is actually a side effect of the freedoms that people get from the software. I should mention that languages like Spanish and most romantic languages get this free adjective right. In Spanish, we have the adjective libre, which means free as in freedom, and gratis, which means free as in price. English is one of the few languages on the planet that has this problem. So I'm hoping one day we'll be a truly bilingual society, and I can say libre and gratis, and there's no confusion anymore with this adjective. So what I'm going to give now is the sort of formal definition of free software. With free software, you get four basic freedoms, and the freedoms are always defined in terms of you, a particular user of the software. And this is important, because what may be free software for one person, the same exact program doing the same exact job, may not be free software for another person. And I'll explain a little bit later about how that happens. The first freedom that you get with free software is the freedom to run the program for any purpose. So anything you can think to do with that software program, you're permitted to do it, even if your idea of using that software program is completely different from what the original developer or developers of the program intended. So that's the first freedom, your freedom to run the program for any purpose. The second freedom that you get with free software is the freedom to help yourself by changing the software or modifying it to suit your needs. Now, you don't have to be a programmer to take advantage of it. Of course, programmers can take direct advantage of this freedom. They know how to change the software themselves. Non-programmers get a benefit, too, because they have the freedom to hire anyone they want to work on the software for them. They can pick and choose who fixes their software for them. So even if you're not a programmer, that freedom to modify the software is very important because it decides, for example, if you're a business, what contracting firms you can hire. With free software, you can hire any firm you want. With proprietary software, you can't. The third freedom that you get is the freedom to help other people by sharing the software with others. Now again, you can do this sort of sharing not charging people. You can share it with someone because they're your friend and you wanted to give them a copy of that software. Or you can share it as part of a business. You can set up shop and say, I'll sell you copies of this free software for $1,000 a piece or $1,000,000 a piece or $10 a piece. You have the freedom to share in any way that you want for any price that you want. The fourth freedom that you get is the freedom to help the community at large by sharing changes that you've made to the software. You're allowed to modify the software and then share the changes that you made. Again, this can be in two different ways. It can be as an altruistic contribution to the community. You can post to a mailing list or a news group and say, I've made these useful changes to this free software program. I hope someone else will find them useful too. Or you can set up shop as a business and say, for N dollars an hour, I will modify free software for you. Just pay me and I'll modify any free software program you want. So again, the issue of making money is possible. You have a choice. You can charge or you can do it altruistically. So those are the four freedoms. The freedom to run the program, the freedom to help yourself, the freedom to help others, and the freedom to help your community. Now, proprietary software can be defined in terms of the opposite. It is software that gives you none of these freedoms or severely restricts all of these freedoms. It used to be the case that the first freedom, the freedom to run the program, was the only one you got with proprietary software. Now, that freedom is severely impeded by most proprietary software. In fact, recent versions of Microsoft FrontPage forbid you from using that software to create web pages that say bad things about Microsoft. So they have a situation where they're even forbidding you from running the program in certain ways. The other thing that proprietary software often forbids you in terms of running is you're never allowed to figure out how the program works, doing the process of reverse engineering. Most proprietary software licenses prohibit that. And of course, they don't give you the source code to the program, so you can't exercise your freedom to modify it, because even making the most trivial changes to a software program without the source code is basically impossible. All those proprietary licenses forbid you from giving copies to others as a term of the license you agree never to share it with anyone else. So all of these freedoms are stomped upon by proprietary software. Now, there's a whole spectrum of software in between free software and proprietary software. Various programs give you some of these freedoms and not others. What I'm talking mostly about is the difference between the two ends of the spectrum, and I'm happy to take questions at the end about various other types of licenses that give you some freedoms and not others. But the key issue is the two ends, because almost all the software in the world is on one of those two ends of the spectrum. The first thing that I think is an obligation on me as a person putting this forward is to prove to you that these freedoms are important. I have to answer the question why these freedoms are important and what harm is caused when these freedoms are infringed upon. There's lots of things we give up in our society that some might argue are freedoms because it's better for the society. We have traffic lights that say stop and people stop. One might argue that that's impinging on their freedom to drive as fast as they want in any direction that they want at any time that they want. But we as a society have decided that freedom of driving in any direction at any speed is not a freedom that's fundamental to human rights and fundamental for our society. So we decide, well, we don't give people that freedom in our society. And there's no harm in cause in taking it away, at least most people believe, so we let the government take it away from us. What I have to prove to you is that there is direct harm caused by taking these freedoms away from software, so that you can believe that the freedoms are important and thus, hopefully, defend them. Now, it took me basically 16 years to come to this belief that these freedoms were important at all. I'm part of a strange generation, you see, which is sometimes called the GNU generation. We're a group of computer scientists and programmers who came of age when there was already lots of free software available. As far back as I can remember in my professional career, I always had access to at least some free software. So I was skeptical about the issue of software freedom because I lived in this world that had both proprietary and free, and things seemed to be okay. Now, I hope that I can convince you much more quickly than I was convinced myself, but I won't feel bad if I'm unable to because it took me so long to even come to that conclusion myself. My journey in figuring this out began at the age of 10 when I got my first computer. It was a Commodore 64 that my parents had bought for me. It didn't come with any software, really. It just had BASIC burned onto the ROM chip of the computer. But it did come with a floppy drive. It was about this wide and about this long and this wide, about that thick, and it was heavier than my laptop that's in my bag is now. But to some sense, this floppy unit was portable. You could carry it around if you had to. And now, the first thing I wanted was some software when I got my computer after I got sick of writing BASIC programs that printed my name on the screen ad infinitum. So I joined a computer club in my neighborhood. I found that there were other kids my age who also had Commodore 64s. But we were young. We treated the computer like we did any other toy. And our parents had taught us two key things that we should do with our toys. The first thing they said is that we should always share our toys. You should never try to hoard the toy and not let other people have a turn with it, because that wasn't a nice thing for people to do to each other. So we're always told to share our toys with each other. The second thing our parents taught us was that we should invent games that included everyone's toys. This was a big issue when I was a kid, because there were Star Wars figures, which was the most popular toy at the time, and there was a number of knockoffs, action figures that were sort of no-name action figures. And some kids in the neighborhood would say, well, you can't play with us because you don't have official Hasbro-stamped Star Wars figures. And we'd be getting fights about it. So our parents always said, well, make up games that include these other ones so that everybody can play. So when we got these computers, we treated it like any other toy. And we looked for games that fit the requirements our parents had set for us. Well, we quickly discovered some. As I mentioned, these 1541 drives were basically portable. We found that if we carried them over to each other's houses and we plugged one into another and then ran another cable into the computer, we could copy floppy disks from one to the other. Well, we discovered that if one person had a video game, you could copy the floppy disk, and then everybody could take a copy home, and everybody would have the game. So this fit the requirements, right? We invented a game that included everybody's toys, i.e. making copies of software, which you needed multiple computers or at least multiple floppy drives for. And we found that it included everyone because at the end of the session, everybody went home with a copy of the video game. We played nicer together with these computers than we ever did with our Star Wars figures, so our parents were happy with what we were doing. They thought we were doing a good thing. It wasn't too long, though, before we discovered that not everybody felt the same way. One month I went to that computer club, and an older woman, who was probably in her 30s at the time, but she seemed ancient to me, 10 years old, was giving a presentation about a new computer game she had just gotten. Evelyn was presenting this game called Little Computer People, and the premise was that a little person lived inside your computer, and you had to bring him a newspaper and feed him and feed his dog and have conversations with him. He had this, well, you typed and he talked back. He had this voice that sounded like the Charlie Brown the parents in the Charlie Brown cartoons. And the coolest thing about this game was that it remembered by the system clock when you had last played it. And if you hadn't played it in a while, when you booted it up, the person said, why haven't you been by to see me in so long? My dog is starving and I haven't seen a newspaper in weeks. So I couldn't wait till she finished her presentation. I leaped up at the end and said, please, Evelyn, could I have a copy of this game? And her eyes darted a little bit. My first thought was, perhaps she didn't have time that day to make the copy. So I told her that my parents could drive me over to her house the next day and I could bring my floppy drive and the copy would only take a few minutes. But that didn't seem to be okay with her either. She kept avoiding the issue and didn't want to make me a copy. Finally, she looked at me and said, it's illegal. for me to give you a copy of this game. I was taken aback, and I said, well, it can't be illegal. My friends and I do this all the time. In fact, it's a lot of fun. And she looked at me, and she told me that my friends and I were criminals. In fact, she had a specific word for the kind of criminals we were. She said that we were pirates. Now, at 10 years old, watching cartoons, I had a very clear idea of what a pirate was. And in my mind, as she said this, I flashed to this imaginary Scooby-Doo episode where the villain of the week was Software Pirates. And I imagined Fred, the ascot-wearing male of the ascot-wearing alpha male of the Mystery Machine, explaining to everyone how we had made these terrible illegal copies of software. I imagine Shaggy ripping off my mask and saying, I would have gotten away with it too if it wasn't for you darn kids. This image of what we were doing didn't fit with what I saw. I saw myself doing what my parents had asked me to do. I saw my friends and I doing good things for each other. Of course, I couldn't express that to her at my young age, so I did what any self-respecting 10-year-old would do. I told her she was mean and stormed out of the meeting. I, in fact, didn't think about the event until about 8 years later when I got my first job doing computer programming professionally. And I had almost the same experience happen to me, although the stakes were a lot higher. I got my first job writing software for a blood typing laboratory on a Unix System 5 release 2.3.2 running on an AT&T 3B2600. I was so excited to actually get to use a real computer for the first time. I even enjoyed learning the VI text editor. It was a few months before I discovered Emacs and realized that was a better choice. And we developed software at this blood typing laboratory for their database systems. We used a proprietary software database product called Informix. All our software we built depended on the underlying Informix libraries of code. When we wrote software, it required other code from Informix to work properly. So we were completely dependent on the software to make our own software run. And as I started to do my job, I began, like any programmer does, to discover bugs in my programs. After being there a couple of months, I discovered this really insidious bug, and I spent weeks trying to figure out what was wrong. I'd learned enough of, and still being a young programmer, I at least learned enough about the art of programming that when you find a bug, you should try to get the code down to as little as possible that can exhibit the bug. Because if you do this, you can audit the code line by line and figure out where the bug might be. So I had done this, and I'd gotten the code that exhibited the bug down to about 30 lines. I still couldn't figure it out. So I took it to one of the more experienced programmers there at where I worked, and I said, Greg, could you help me find this bug in the program? I can't figure it out. So he, too, audited the 30 lines of code and said, I don't think there's any bug here at all. What I think is going on is there's a bug in the underlying Informix library. Now, I was naive enough to think that if software came in a box shrink-wrapped from some big corporation, that it couldn't possibly have any bugs in it. So I argued for a while, saying, no, it couldn't be. There must be something wrong with my program. And Greg said, I've been working with Informix software for about 8 years. They have tons of bugs. He said, but fortunately, we have a tech support contract. So you can call them up and report the bug, and they'll tell you how to fix it or how to work around it. So I got the 800 number, and I dutifully called, and after being on hold for a while, I got connected to a programmer tech support representative. I explained the bug to him. I even emailed him that 30 lines of code so that he could exhibit it there on his own systems. He called me back the next day or a few days later and said, yeah, it looks like this is a bug, and it doesn't appear to be fixed on the 3B2 platform. I don't know if there's a workaround, so I'm not sure what you're going to do. I said, well, I really need to get this working and get it fixed. What's going on? Why did you say it's not fixed on the 3B2 platform? Is it fixed on other platforms? He said, oh, yeah, this has been fixed in Solaris for a while, but isn't fixed on the 3B2. I said, well, that can't be. What do you mean? I mean, you can't just port the fix over? And he said, no, I'm looking at the code right now, and it's clear that it's fixed in a very Solaris-specific way. And I said, you're looking at the code right now. He said, yeah, and this fix is not going to work for you. Now, this was surreal, because he was looking at the source code to this program, and we had become, at our job, experts on this 3B2 architecture, because we had to work with it every day, and we knew its quirks, and we knew how to get things to work on it pretty well. If we had had that source code, we probably could have figured out how to make it work on the 3B2. I probably couldn't have. I was too young of a programmer then, but Greg probably could have figured it out. But he couldn't give us the source code. In fact, I didn't even ask. I had learned 8 years before what happens when you ask someone for software who doesn't want to give it to you. I also knew something else by then. I knew that this tech support representative had probably signed a non-disclosure agreement with Informix. That, too, is quite surreal, because he was hired in the job of supporting other programmers. Yet, he was, as a term of his employment, required to sign a contract that forbid him to help programmers in the most natural way two programmers help each other. You see, when programmers are having a problem, they look at each other's source code and try to figure out what's going on. But this programmer tech support guy was forbidden from showing us that source code he was looking at. It must have been a very sad job to have, to just answer the phone all day and say, yes, it's a bug, no, we don't know when it'll be fixed, may I close out the bug report, please? He wasn't allowed to help these other programmers. And what I discovered from this experience is that not only is productivity lost, as I lost weeks looking for this bug, but the community of programmers is impacted. The community of programmers is decimated, because one programmer is forbidden from helping another, is forbidden from helping another, and there's walls between everybody in the field from being able to help each other. This is not what I thought computer science was about. In fact, that Informix tech support fellow seemed like a nice guy. He probably would have wanted to collaborate on fixing the problem. My employer wouldn't have minded. They were, in fact, mad at the fact that it was taking so long to get our software finished. They would have happily paid us to work on Informix's software if it meant getting the whole project done faster. And we would have fed our patches back to Informix, and they would have had a fix on that 3B2 platform for all their other customers. But we didn't have the freedom to do that. We were forbidden because of proprietary software licensing and non-disclosure agreements. It was even sadder, though, to find out that the rest of my career, at least in the proprietary software industry, would turn out much the same. I was always in this position of either being helpless because someone refused to share with me, or being in an even worse position where I was acting in the same way the Informix tech support person was. I decided that I just didn't want to do programming anymore. At the time, I thought I just didn't like programming. What I didn't like, actually, was proprietary software programming. But I hadn't figured that out yet. But I'd heard about another career in the industry where you didn't have to do any work at all, and you just sat around all day, and it was all really easy, called system administration. Of course, once I got my first sysadmin job, I realized those were all lies spread by non-sysadmins. But at the time, I thought it would all work out great. Once I got my first sysadmin job at Westinghouse, I realized that the user community was having the same, was receiving the same effect that the programming community was because of proprietary software bugs. You see, any software system eventually is going to have an end user, some person who depends on that software to get some work done or to get their job done. When I was a sysadmin at Westinghouse, we were running these older Sun machines, running an old version of Solaris at the time, which was 2.4, it was old at the time. And I was supporting a group of programmers writing software for mobile telephones. And they had to use these Sun systems every day to get their work done and get the mobile phones working. Mobile phones, actually there were satellite telephones used in by forest rangers and so forth to do rescue operations. When your mobile network is down, you have a satellite link. So it was important work. It needed to get supported, and I was hired in the job to support the programmers to get the work done. We were using Solaris with a system called NIS Plus. This is an authentication system that's all proprietary, invented by Sun. Well, it's different than the traditional NIS, which is free software and not very secure. The NIS Plus system that we're using used the XDM program, the X Display Manager, to handle logins when people logged in the morning. there had been a bug for a while, they hadn't had a sysadmin for a long time, that they had been dealing with every day. When they came in the morning, all the developers would come in and try to log into their terminals. And it would tell them login incorrect, even if they typed their username and password correctly. They found, though, that if they had logged in the night before, remotely, over the internet or from some other system, if they had logged in that way in the last 12 hours, that everything worked fine. For some reason, if you logged in remotely first, then tried to log in through XDM, everything worked fine. So every morning, everyone would come in, try to log in. Some would get in, some wouldn't. And the ones who didn't get in would walk around to other people's terminals who happened to get in and log in remotely back to their own machine on their desk, which would be permitted. Then they'd walk back to their desk, log into their own terminal, and everything would work fine. This took about 45 minutes every morning. Because you see, people would wander over to someone else's cubicle and they'd start a conversation and then wander back. And management, the first thing they said to me is, fix that bug, we're losing all kinds of productivity because of it. So I started poking around, and eventually I discovered that it was indeed a bug in the version of XDM that Solaris was shipping. They had modified XDM to work with NIS Plus, and they had introduced a bug in the process. So I called the tech support. Again, we had a tech support contract. And I explained the bug to them, and they said, yeah, it's fixed in the later versions of Solaris, but there's not a 2.4 fix coming out. And I was forbidden to upgrade from 2.4 because they had done a full regression test of the entire development process. That was very costly, and they didn't want to redo that regression test just for a new version of the operating system, but we were allowed to install only bug fix patches if they were small and we could describe exactly what they did. So I needed a bug fix patch, not a whole new release of the system. Besides, we couldn't afford buying a whole new release of the operating system anyway. So I said, well, I looked on your patches website, and I noticed that in 2.4, similar bugs to this related to NIS Plus got fixed, but not this particular one. Why is it that you're fixing these other ones? They said, well, NASA asked for those, and NASA's really big, so they can put pressure on Sun, and we fix those, but you're simply not big enough to put that kind of pressure on us. You're not a big enough company. I was amazed to learn that Westinghouse is a small company, but apparently they are, at least compared to NASA. So I turned around, and I found myself delivering the same message to my users that had been delivered to me so many times. I said, yes, this is a bug in the version of the software we're using. No, I don't know when it'll be fixed. Let's just make sure somebody logs in overnight every day so that somebody can log in the morning. And this, of course, this isn't to say that free software is without bugs. We have plenty of them. We have more than our share of bugs, some people say. And it's not even to say that if you find a bug in a free software program, the original developer will care. You may email that original developer, and she or he will say, no, I'm not going to fix that bug. I don't want to worry about it. That can happen with free software, certainly. The difference is that you care. And in the case of Westinghouse, the difference would have been that me and my company and my users cared. If it had been free software, I could have probably fixed it myself. If I didn't know how to fix it myself, I could have gone to my manager and said, we need to bring in an expert to fix this software. If it had been free software, we would have had the freedom to choose anyone we wanted to fix the software. Since it was proprietary, we had one person to ask, Sun and their licensed authorized dealers, and Sun and their authorized dealers were not interested in fixing the bug. We were left helpless, prisoners to this proprietary software. I became convinced after a while that computers in general were just never going to be easy to use because nobody seemed to care that there were all these bugs and nobody wanted to put the effort into fixing them unless you were as big as NASA. And this poor treatment of users is what bothered me most. The fact that end users of the computers were treated in this way like they didn't matter. This became most apparent to me when I took a short-term contract working for Lucent Technologies. I got a job working on this configuration program for telephone switches. We wrote this program at Lucent because these telephone switches are sort of very high-tech devices, and there's always a couple of gurus at any Baby Bell who knows how to log directly into the switch and make it work, but their time is very limited. So they needed an interface program that made any tech support person at a terminal able to configure the telephone switch to, you know, add call waiting for you and that sort of thing. So Lucent made a lot of money selling this technology to the Baby Bells all around the country. This is when there were still Baby Bells in the traditional sense. And when I first got there, they were going to do a redesign of the system. The system had already been around for 10 years. It had a lot of cruft, and it had a lot of problems with it. And they called this big user group meeting, where they brought users from all the baby bells around the country to come and talk about the problems they have with the system. I was actually really excited when I heard this. I said, wow, this company's really taking its users seriously. And I excitedly went to the meeting and took dutiful notes about all the bugs they were talking about. After one of the days of this conference that we had, I came back to my desk and was looking through my notes and discovered that there was a bug in the system, the old system. But the new system that we were designing was designed in a way that made it easy to fix this bug. And this bug was really bad. It required the users to type this really complex key sequence, navigating through a number of menus just to get to a very simple option, an option that they used a number of times a day. Because this old system was so poorly built, it lagged terribly. So they'd hit this 12-key sequence, and it would take a good minute to a minute and a half to get down to that bottom menu. If they hit the wrong key anywhere in that sequence, they'd have to back all the way out and go back in. They're using this many, many times a day. It wasted a lot of time for them. And every single user was complaining about it. So I told my manager, excited, I said, our new design, they're not going to have that bug at all. We have this great new configuration system for the menus. They can change it any way they like. And he looked at me and said, well, make sure you can turn that off by default. I said, well, why do we want that off by default? I think it should be on by default. After all, you know, that's what they wanted and so forth. He said, no, you don't understand what I'm saying. We need to sell that as an additional upgrade. We can't just give it to them. Now, every one of these baby bells was paying monthly tech support contracts that included upgrades. Not only that, but I had just learned that this division of Lucent of about 50 people was turning profits on the order of a couple hundred thousand dollars every month. They clearly had enough money to give upgrades, and they were getting support contracts anyway that required them to give upgrades. Yet they were going to hide this feature and sell it as a special add-on to make even more money. What I discovered, what was happening in the proprietary software industry, was that profit was more important than anything else, more important than the users, more important than ease of use, more important than people's lives. And this was not why I got into computer science. I got into computer science to make the world better with technology. What's the point of doing technology if it doesn't make people's lives better? But I lived in this proprietary software world, and I was even told at a young age of 10 to think it was ethically wrong to think of software any other way. Now, this is not to say that I or the Free Software Foundation I work for are against profit. We think profit's a fine thing. There's nothing wrong with it. What I'm saying is that profit should not be the number one motive in what we do, in particular what we do in the software world. Fine, make it number two if you want. But I think number one, the number one goal of computer software should be to make it better for users and to make the world a better place and to make technology better. And then let's figure out how to make a profit doing that. But in my professional career in this proprietary software world, I just became more apathetic. I couldn't figure out what to do until I started to really look at what was going on and saw that in my private life, for a long time, I had that freedom that I was missing at work all the time. This was because in 1992, I became an early adopter of the GNU plus Linux operating system. Of course, in those days, I mistakenly called it Linux, but I'll get to that issue later. And I didn't understand these issues of freedom and sharing software and so forth. All I wanted was a reasonable Unix-like operating system to run on my home PC to do my computer science homework at school. And I installed it on my own machine, and I told some of my professors about it. And they were looking to build a new lab with Unix-like systems for the computer science students. And they couldn't really afford to buy Sun hardware. And they said, well, we're going to buy a bunch of PC hardware. Why don't you come in for the summer on a grant and install GNU Linux on all these systems? So even when I was in college, I was getting paid to work on free software. I had a free software business of sorts. So I came in that summer, and we got the machine set up, and I installed GNU Linux on every machine. And I discovered that I had a real problem, though. You see, this lab was replacing an older lab that was running an operating system that required you to hit Control-Alt-Delete, this key sequence, a whole lot, apparently all the time. And we didn't want, and this key sequence apparently reboots the machine, so I'm told. And apparently had to reboot these other machines running some other operating system all the time. I don't know what that operating system was exactly, but required lots of reboots. Of course, we didn't want people to reboot these GNU Linux machines for a number of reasons, not the least of which was that people were using them remotely, too. So somebody might come in, hit Control-Alt-Delete, reboot the machine, and then some person logged in remotely, we get kicked off. We didn't want that to happen. So we had to find a way to make this key sequence not do that. I found that all these GNU Linux machines I installed, I pressed Control-Alt-Delete, and they rebooted immediately. And I started looking around and realized that in those days, this option was not configurable. These days, it's completely configurable through the init system, but in those days, it was hard-coded. So I said, well, I don't know what to do here. I don't have tech support like I do at work. I can't call somebody. And I guess if I actually called somebody, they'd probably tell me, yes, it's a bug, and no, they don't know when it'll be fixed. But I don't have tech support, so what else am I going to do? Well, I had something much more useful than tech support. I had the source code to the entire operating system and the freedom to modify that source code. So being a young, brash programmer, I said, well, it's just source code. I'm sure I can figure it out. So I started grepping the source code of the Linux, of a kernel named Linux, looking for the phrase Control-Alt-Delete. I found a function in the C language called Control_Alt_Delete. It had a body that did a bunch of things. And I thought, well, you know, if some code doesn't do what you want, you could just comment it out, and everything will probably work fine. And usually that's a very bad rule to follow as a programmer. But in this particular case, it was exactly what was needed. I commented out the body of that function. I recompiled the kernel named Linux and installed it across the network. And I went around to each machine hitting Control-Alt-Delete, and absolutely nothing happened, which was precisely the behavior we wanted. Now, this whole process took about an hour and a half, and it was a really rewarding and exhilarating experience. I think it's liberating for people when you give them the means to solve their own problems rather than requiring them to beg someone else to solve their problems for them. Because of this experience and others like it, by the mid-1990s, I was really beginning to understand that this issue of freedom was central to the entire computer software industry. Now, for everyone else, and probably most of you, all this stuff didn't come on the radar screen until the late 1990s. And that's when the mainstream media picked it up. And like often happens in the mainstream media, there were a number of sort of mainstream-friendly terms that were adopted. It got talked about in terms of open source rather than free software. They talked about in terms of Linux. That was the buzzword that everybody got excited about. But there's a lot more history to the community that made all this possible, that has really never gotten talked about in the mainstream media in any real way. Way back in 1984, when I was busy at a Commodore 64 club being called a computer pirate, Richard Stallman was making these same observations about the computer software world that I'm talking about today. What he realized was that the world was changing, that there had been free software pretty much everywhere. The vendors just gave you the software along with a computer when you bought it. Everybody modified it and shared it. But things were changing in the mid-1980s, and that wasn't happening anymore. Companies had decided that they could make a lot of money by dividing the user base and conquering each person one by one by using something called a copyright license. They invented the idea of licensing software to you and saying, you can have a copy of the software, but you're forbidden from giving a copy to him, and you're forbidden from sharing it with him, and you're forbidden from looking at the source code or trying to figure out how it works by a term of this agreement. They had discovered a way, of course, to charge each person a little bit of money for a copy of the software program and forbid them from giving it to anyone else so they can get each person to pay. And what Richard Stallman saw was that this created a different kind of world than what he had known in the pre-existing free software world. So he invented a movement to get back to the other way of doing things. He invented the idea of the free software movement. But the most interesting thing about this early movement was that it had a practical goal. It said, instead of just, you know, standing outside of proprietary software companies saying, make your software free or we're going to write nasty letters and complain a lot, which is sometimes all you can do when there's a social injustice. If you have no power to make it better, that's the best you can do, and a lot of times that's all you can do. But computer software was different, because anyone who had access to a computer and a mind for programming could invent new software. So along with the free software movement, the GNU project was started. The idea was to create a completely free software operating system that would make computers run to give people an alternative to what proprietary software was out there already, to give users a choice so that they could choose freedom if they wanted it. And the idea was to make a better society. You see, the GNU project has always been about the idea of freedom. That was the reason for doing it. The fact that the free software movement invents lots of interesting technology is a side effect of this drive to make the world a freer place. You see, that divide and conquer mechanism of proprietary software licensing puts people in a very unfair position. When I think of Evelyn, I think it wasn't very fair for her to have to choose between two things. She had to choose between obeying the software license that she got with that program, Little Computer People, and doing what seemed right for humanity, making a child happy, giving someone something, giving somebody a gift. She had to choose between these two drives, whether to obey the law or to obey her good nature. I don't think laws should put people in that position. The reason we have laws in this society is to make the world better, to facilitate goodwill among people. The copyright system, as it's typically applied to computer software in the proprietary way, uses laws to go against people's natural urges to help each other. Some people do make out well, of course. You can make a lot of profit doing this divide and conquer mechanism. In fact, the richest human being in the world now made his money that way. But as I said before, I don't think profit should be the highest motive. Many companies can and do make money developing, supporting, documenting free software. Red Hat, particularly through its Cygnus division, is profitable. There's small companies like Code Sorcery that does similar work and is able to support a shop of 5 or 6 people doing software development. There's MySQLAB in Sweden. There's 2 companies in France called Alcove and Easter Eggs that support free software as part of their business. And the way that they make money doing free software is the typical ways that money is made in the software industry. In fact, being at IBM, it's the way that IBM invented making money in the software industry. Through service, through custom modifications on contracts, and through support contracts. Most money in the software industry is made this way. Only the very, very few are able to make money with this divide and conquer mechanism. Most people make money through support contracts. But back in the mid-1980s, there wasn't any of this vibrant free software community supporting free software and having companies to do so. The industry had become dominated by this proprietary software mechanism. The GNU project put forward an alternative to build a completely new community from scratch based around freedom. Of course, there was a key problem as the software got developed. One way you can always develop software is to build it all and then release it in one big chunk. But there was useful software being developed even in the first year in 1985, and the people working on the GNU project at the time wanted to make it available to the world. And then they had a key problem. What should be the terms of distribution of that software? The easiest way to turn some software into free software, if you want to do it, is to release it into the public domain. That means that you assert no copyright whatsoever on that software. You just release it out there for everyone and don't copyright it. There's a side effect to that, though. If there's no copyright on it and it's in the public domain, anyone else who would like to can pick up that software, assert their own copyright on it, and then license it under any terms that they want to. Now, if this had been the terms of distribution for the original GNU programs, the free software movement probably would have been a failure. Because what would have happened was, if the software got useful enough, proprietary software companies would have picked it up, made a few modifications to it to make it better. Since it was in the public domain, they could assert their own copyright on it, and then license it back to the public under proprietary software licensing terms. Thus, the GNU project will be forced to compete with own versions of itself. The free software people will release a new public domain version, proprietary software company will release a new proprietary version with some modifications, and they have to chase each other to keep up. So Richard Stallman sat down with a couple of lawyers and invented the idea of copyleft. Think of copyleft as copyright turned over or turned on its head. The idea was to copyright the program and then use copyright law rather than to restrict people's freedoms as it was traditionally used, but to defend people's freedoms. So proprietary copyright licenses say, here's a copy of the program and you may not do this, you may not do this, you may not do this. You may not copy it, you may not modify it, you may not distribute it. Copylefted programs say, yes, this software is copyrighted. And under terms of copyright, we assert your freedom to run the program and copy it and share it and modify it all you want. The only restriction we place on you is that you don't take those freedoms away from anyone else when you exercise them. So if you distribute it to someone else, you have to pass along the same freedoms that you got with the program. It uses copyright to grant people freedom, but forbid each person to forbid others those freedoms. And because of this strategy of encouraging sharing through the law, using the law in the way I think it should be used to facilitate goodwill, it's made a huge body of free software. Today, the GNU General Public License, the implementation of copyleft that was written by the GNU Project, is the most widely used free software license today. I should note, though, that copyleft is, as I said, only a strategy. It's a way to get people to share with each other and to encourage and foster freedom. There's other strategies that exist. The FreeBSD system, for example, is completely free software. You get all these freedoms with it when you download it. But it's not copylefted free software. It's not under the GNU GPL. So proprietary companies are able to take FreeBSD, modify it, and release a proprietary version, and some companies do that. The FreeBSD community has other ways that they encourage cooperation. They say things to these proprietary companies like, well, since you're doing this proprietary, we're going to make sure that future versions of FreeBSD don't support what you're doing, and you're going to constantly have to catch up with us. And they have enough force to sort of make that happen, and they often pressure companies to not do proprietary software anymore. The reason I prefer copyleft in the GNU GPL is I like the fact that there's a legal defense for freedom, that we can use copyright law to defend people's freedom. And I think that's exactly what laws exist for, and I'm happy to use them that way, to defend freedom. But this FreeBSD strategy can work, and the GNU project didn't want to reinvent the wheel every time just because a particular program wasn't copylefted. The modus operandi of the GNU project was find the most straightforward, easiest way to get free software out there to the public. And if you find a useful free software program, don't discard it just because it's not under our license. Incorporate it into the GNU system if we can, so that we can get to the point where there's a fully usable operating system with application software out there. So over the years, lots of other free software programs were adopted by the GNU project. In 1989, the GNU project adopted the TEC document formatting system written by Donald Knuth. In 1990, the GNU adopted the X Windows windowing system, which is what displays the various different windows on your screen, the low-level libraries that used to do that. And by 1991, the GNU developers had either found or written themselves all the pieces they needed for a whole operating system, except for one. Nobody had really started the kernel of the operating system yet. For those of you that aren't too technical, the kernel is the part of the operating system that talks to the hardware directly on behalf of all the other programs and manages various different users being logged in and so forth. Now, the GNU project started its own kernel in that year, 1991, called Herd. But it took a very strange approach, and I still, to this day, do not understand why. As I said, the GNU project always took the attitude of get the software written in the most straightforward way. Don't try anything experimental or risky. That'll take longer to get freedom to the users. Take the most straightforward method. Herd took the most experimental method of kernel development available at the time in 1991. It's a microkerneled architecture that turned out to be very difficult to develop. Only today are GNU/Herd systems getting to the point where they're stable for non-developer users to use. But meanwhile, that same year, another person started writing a kernel in the traditional way that the GNU project did its projects. Linus Torvald, working in Finland, started writing his own kernel from scratch that used the tried and true monolithic approach to kernel development. And within a year, he had a working kernel that could be used in an operating system. He released it under the terms of the GNU General Public License, the license the GNU project used, after being convinced to do so by some friends, and because he had found the license in the compiler he was using, the GNU C compiler, decided it was a good license to use and released the software to the world. Others downloaded this new kernel package and realized that a kernel doesn't do the whole job of an operating system. In fact, it's only one small part. And they went looking around for other free software that might be added to Linux to make a complete operating system. Lo and behold, they found that all the software they needed to make an operating system was already available. They thought, wow, what luck, it's all already there. I can put an operating system together and distribute it. But it wasn't just luck. What they found were the unassembled pieces of the GNU system that the GNU project had been either developing or discovering and putting together over a number of years. By adding Linux, they made a complete operating system. This is the reason that we can even presume to ask you to call the operating system by the name GNU plus Linux or GNU/Linux or GNU Linux, whatever you want to write or say, something like that. That gives us a sort of fair ground to ask for that. But that's not the reason we ask. We don't ask it just for credit's sake. It's not about sour grapes. It's not about ego of the GNU project. If it were about that, we would say, fine, just call it whatever you want. The reason that we actually ask for this favor, and it is asking a favor, is because the idea of freedom and the philosophy of getting freedom to lots of users is embodied by the GNU project. The Linux project is not about that. It's primarily an open source oriented project that's focused on the idea of technology but not the issue of freedom. When people hear that the operating system is called Linux, they think, oh, what's the philosophy of Linux? It must be the philosophy of its developers, like Linus Torvalds. Linus Torvalds doesn't have any philosophy about the software freedom in the way that I'm talking about. That's not his philosophy. It's his right to have his own philosophy and to associate whatever he believes with his project. The problem that comes up is that when people think that's the philosophy of the entire community, they don't realize this issue of freedom is what's important. Not a month goes by that we don't get an email at the Free Software Foundation that says something like this. I'm a Linux user. I read about your crazy free software philosophies on your website. I don't think these kind of ideas can ever make a viable operating system. I'll just keep using Linux instead. Thanks very much. How ironic. They don't even realize that most of what they're using are pieces of the GNU project, and the license that made Linux popular is the license of the GNU project. They don't know because they think it's the philosophy of Linux's developers. So this is why we ask this favor. We believe in free speech rights. We're not demanding or requiring you to call the operating system by any name. We believe you have a free speech right to call it Foo if you want to call it Foo. We ask as a favor if you would please call it GNU Linux to remind everyone about this issue of freedom. Now, the same, as I mentioned, the same issue comes up in a number of cases because these terms that became media friendly and popular hide this issue of freedom. Open source is a great example. What happened in 1998 was a group of people got together and said that they'd like to create, quote, a marketing organization for free software, a way to convince business people to get excited about free software. And they decided that the way to convince business people was to downplay this freedom aspect. And I think that's a laudable goal. If you can convince people to use free software without telling them about the freedom stuff, and if the freedom stuff scares them, then fine, convince them and don't mention it. The problem that happened was that open source became the buzzword. and that people didn't talk about the freedom aspects. Everybody was talking about how it made bugs easy to find, and how all the technology was reliable and dependable, and so forth. But the truth of the matter is that free software isn't always perfectly reliable. It isn't always bug-free, and it needs a lot of work to get better. But despite that, I still think it's the right thing to do because of this issue of freedom. When you hide that issue of freedom, it's easy to dismiss the arguments of open source because they're so focused on the idea of technology and the practical matters of what the software does. Now, these are two different movements trying to convince the world to use free software or open source software, as it might be called, in different ways. It's up to you to decide what strategy you like using and what movement you support. Maybe you think that this idea of freedom is important and is what really matters. If that's the case, you're probably a supporter of the free software movement. Maybe you think that the technology is what matters, and if really this freedom stuff is kind of goofy and you're not interested, but you still like the technology. In that case, you're probably a supporter of the open source movement. Maybe you hate all free software and think it should be proprietary. In that case, you don't support either movement, and you probably want to go talk to Microsoft. But it's up to you to pick which one you support and to say which one you support. I hope you'll choose to support the freedom side and talk about software freedom and free software. And I hope also that if you do pick to support other ideas, that you'll make this distinction clear, that there is a difference between the two, and it's a philosophical difference. It's not in the technical details. It's about what your philosophy of software is. The reason I continue to support the free software movement is because I believe that computer scientists have an obligation to consider the ethical and sociological impact of what they do. Software use is growing beyond the fields of science, and it's now a part of everybody's life almost every day, at least in the industrialized world. I encourage you to reject the seeming convenience of just going on using proprietary software. A lot of people say, I use proprietary software because I don't have a choice. It's fortunate that you still do have a choice today. If you're a software developer, you don't have to accept a job developing proprietary software. Maybe it means you can't work in the software industry, but there are millions of people in the world, even today, that make a living not developing software. Most software developers are amazed by this. But there are jobs you can do. Become a math teacher, if nothing else. We need more teachers in the world, and any computer scientist is probably good enough to teach math as well. So go to your local high school and get a job teaching math rather than developing proprietary software. I hope you'll make that kind of choice and not assume that you have to do it just because it's what most of the industry does. And if you want to stay in the software industry, you can make a living developing, documenting, teaching about, and supporting free software. Now, it's hard in this economy to get a job doing anything in the technology industry, and free software is affected too, but it doesn't mean you can't still do it if you give it a go. So I hope you'll choose to try to do that. Now, there's a lot working against you, I realize. There's proprietary software companies out there saying that free software stops innovation. Microsoft launched a campaign last year to slander the GNU GPL as an un-American cancerous virus that would eat up all software like a Pac-Man, they said, which is direct quotes from various different executives at Microsoft. I think you should be skeptical about what a company like that says. They're not thinking about what's best for society. They're going to think about what's best for their business. And they're attacking free software, and GPL software in particular, because they don't want people to have a choice of freedom. Because when you have freedom, it creates a competitive free market. In fact, under a more general free software model, if free software takes over more of the industry, I believe that it will work like other industries that we're used to today. Consider the field of law, for example. The law is a free resource. You can go to a law library and read about law. You're allowed to defend yourself in court. You're allowed to file court documents yourself. These are all things that are permitted, and you're permitted to do them freely. Yet lawyers still seem to make a lot of money. Why is that? Because there's always a market for experts. You don't defend yourself in court or file your own court documents because you don't have the time or the ability or the inclination to learn all the details you need to know to be able to do that yourself. You call an expert, and you're willing to pay that expert for their time. Free software works basically the same way. You hire experts to do jobs when you need an expert. Auto mechanics works similarly. You know, when I used to own a car, I don't anymore, but when I used to, I always took it to the dealer because I never knew who to go to. You know, I never knew what a good mechanic was versus a mechanic who's trying to cheat you. So I always took it to the dealer, and I paid extra money so that there was donuts there and coffee when I got there. And I knew I was paying more than I really needed to. But lots of my friends took their same model Honda Accords to local mechanics and paid less a lot of the time. You see, auto mechanics is pretty much an open and free technology. You can get the auto manuals from the manufacturer and learn how cars work and open up a shop of your own to fix cars. Or you can go to, or you know, people can go to the dealer if they want to, if they want that high level of service. A lot of people fix their cars themselves. They get the manuals and a lot of people at least know how to change their oil, and some people even do more substantial work themselves. They have the freedom to do that. Yet there's still a market for a vibrant marketplace of auto mechanics, from the mom-and-pop auto shop to the dealer. Free software is the same way. You have mom-and-pop shops, and you have three and four and five-person shops, which I know there are lots of. I've met lots of people who run them. And there's also big companies like Red Hat and IBM, for example, that support free software if you want that higher level of service. The third industry that works much like this, too, is medicine. A few years ago, I went to my doctor, and I was told that I had high liver function, that I needed to lose weight and exercise more so that my liver functions would go down. And in fact, I exercised and lost some weight, which I've now gained back, and my liver functions went down. Now, I've told you this advice, so the next time you get a blood test and find out you have high liver functions, you could probably just take my advice and do what I did, and it worked. But you're probably not going to, and I encourage you not to. You're going to ask an expert. You're going to say, your doctor who knows your situation, ask them what you should do, and you're going to pay them for the service, or your insurance company will. There's always a market for experts, and there's a market there for free software. What free software does, the way free software creates these kind of expert industries like law and auto mechanics and medicine, is that free software creates a marketplace where there's equal footing. Small companies are on equal footing to compete with big companies, because they have equal access to a shared commons. A shared commons the way that law is a shared commons, the way that medical information is a shared commons, the way that the auto mechanics information, for the most part, is a shared commons. And I think that's the best way to carry out the mission of computer science, by not forcing customers and clients and users to be locked into one technology, but to allow them to pick from the whole market of technologies and decide which ones they want and be allowed to switch when they want to. You can't switch from one proprietary software vendor to another without lots of work. With one free software vendor to another, most of the time, you just hire a different consulting company. Now, the GPL, as I mentioned, is being highly criticized, and it's being singled out among all the free software licenses, particularly because its requirements that derivative works of a particular program be made free software, that you're required to get past the freedoms along, as I was talking about earlier. Now, the criticism against GPL is based on what I believe is a mistaken assumption, the idea that someone should be allowed to benefit from a shared commons without contributing back to it. Microsoft and other proprietary software companies are happy to benefit from free software when they don't have to give anything back. Microsoft has a clear philosophy of embrace, proprietorize, and extend. Microsoft has taken the Kerberos system and added it to its own operating system without contributing back to the Kerberos project. If you look at the FTP client on any Windows machine, it's in fact a modified version of the FTP client from the Berkeley folks under the modified Berkeley license. That XDM program that I had so much trouble with back at Westinghouse on Solaris was in fact a free software program originally. Sun downloaded it from MIT's website, or their FTP site in those days. They modified it to work with their proprietary NIS Plus system, and they turned around and shipped it to Westinghouse without the source code, completely proprietary. This is because it was not copylefted free software. They were allowed to do this and leave us helpless in the same way we'd be helpless with something that was always free software. I mean, always proprietary software, never had been free software in its history. The GPL prohibits this sort of activity. It prohibits people from benefiting without contributing back. It's kind of like a club where no one's required to join. No one is mandating that you use free software or GPL software. But if you choose to use it and then modify and redistribute, you have to obey the rules of the club that you join by doing that activity. It keeps companies honest when they want to benefit from this community. It makes sure that we don't have the tragedy of the commons, where everyone takes and no one gives, because everyone's required to give if they get involved. Now, you're going to hear, as I mentioned, lots of PR, and there's going to be more coming from Microsoft and other places. Last year was just the beginning. Last summer was just the beginning. And I want you to, I request that you try to dispel some of this stuff. The GPL isn't a virus. By contrast, it vaccinates you from harm. It creates a level of trust that's really unprecedented in the world. We have GNU developers working on every continent except Antarctica. We have a trust spanning international borders of all kinds of people cooperating together to develop interesting technology because they have a license to work around that makes sure that trust is respected across copyright law in all these different countries. Unfortunately, just as we're getting this great international cooperation, corporations are trying to make this impossible. They're trying to stop people from using and contributing to free software. The legal systems of various countries, the United States in particular, are ramping up to stop free software development completely. I know it sounds rather gloom and doom, but it's true. The first step in this direction was the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA. Michael's wearing a very good button about the DMCA. Title one.
It's her button. I wear
it. Oh, it's your button. No, I'm sorry. I didn't know whose button it was.
Well, no, I am wearing it.
Yes, you are wearing it.
It was my idea.
It's his idea. Your idea. His button. Okay. The credit has been properly given. The DMCA makes it illegal to distribute GPL software that can play certain DVD movies. This is this DECSS that Michael was talking about at the beginning of the meeting. You see, every DVD that comes from the MPAA is encoded with a particular algorithm. That encoding mechanism is programmed into every DVD player that you have, and it figures out how to play the disc and puts it on the screen for you. Some free software developers got together, figured out how this worked by reverse engineering it, and they wrote a GPL program that could decode MPAA-produced DVDs. Under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, DMCA, it is illegal to create and spread information about any technology that can be used to circumvent copyright protection put on a media by a copyright holder. Now, that's the long-winded legal version. What this means in the real world is that if the MPAA finds a way to hide the information on the DVD and you figure out how it works, you're forbidden to tell anybody else about it. In fact, the MPAA argued in court that telling people about this DECSS thing was equivalent to shouting fire in a crowded theater when there really was no fire. They said that you have no free speech right to share this information. This information that has been turned not only into a computer program, but a song, a haiku, and various other forms of expression. We don't have a free speech right to share such information, at least in the United States. You see, what the MPAA wants is the ability to change the way that people deal with their media. We used to have what's called fair use rights in the United States. There were a doctrine established by the courts to think about these copyright issues, mostly established in what's called the Betamax case when VHS cassettes came out. Up until DMCA, it was believed that if there was some use for technology that was not infringing copyright, users had a right to have that technology. For example, you're supposed to have the right to make backup copies of your DVDs in case you drop them on the floor so that you can watch it even though you scratched it. You're supposed to have a fair use right to speed through commercials, although many MPAA-produced DVDs won't let you. What's happening is the MPAA and the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America, are trying to trample over these fair use rights and take them away from the consumers. What they want to produce is things that are a leak-proof pipe from their media to your eyeball and eardrum. Because if there's any leaks in that pipe that you can figure out how things work, you can create a digitally perfect copy of that media. And of course, you can use that copy for various copyright infringing searches, copyright infringing uses like posting it on the internet. But you can also use that for other types of non-infringing uses like making a backup copy. It gets worse than just the United States, though. The FTAA, the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, will extend Title I of the DMCA from the northernmost territories of Canada to the most southern tip of Chile. All of these two continents will be DMCA territory. There's a lot of reasons to oppose the FTAA. This is only one of them, and this is the one that the FSF takes a position on. I encourage you to oppose the FTAA. And the biggest battle that's happening right now is the United States is pushing hard to get the FTAA to be an approved treaty by 2003. It was originally slated for 2005. I encourage you to write to our trade negotiators here in the United States and say, leave it till 2005. Use the original schedule. At least that will buy us some time. So that's what you can do now on that issue. But back in the U.S., it gets even worse. Introduced into the Commerce Committee right now is the CBDTPA, the Consumer Broadband and Digital Television Promotion Act, which is a rename of the FSSCA. It's been theorized by a number of people that they keep making the acronym more difficult to keep us from talking about it. So I've worked hard to master these various acronyms. This law was introduced by Senator Hollings, a Democrat from Southern California, who gets huge contributions from the Disney. South Carolina. What did I say? Southern California? My apologies. He is from South Carolina. And he's supported primarily by Disney. In fact, Disney people wrote most of the bill, along with his staffer named Al Mosswer. And it's now Senate Bill 2048. So you can write your senators today about it and tell them to oppose this bill. It says it's a copyright act, but in fact it's a technology control law masquerading as a copyright law. What it requires is you quote user disabling content protections unquote on all digital devices that play media from MPAA and RIAA. This means that any device you have that can play a DVD or play a CD has to have that leak-proof pipe I was talking about. Now, with free software, there's always a leak in that pipe, because even if we write the free software just perfectly so that it obeys everything MPAA wants, well, we give the user the freedom to change it. The bill says the user cannot be allowed to change it. In fact, some other things that I'm going to talk about in a minute require that the user be frustrated. They literally say it must have user frustration technology that makes them frustrated when they try to modify it. What this bill will do is make free software illegal for these various different tasks, playing DVDs, playing CDs. Now, I don't think this bill is actually going to make it through the Senate and through the House and so forth. This bill is actually a red herring as far as we can tell. What's really going on are backroom deals between the MPAA and various equipment manufacturers. I had the good fortune or bad fortune, depending on the way you look at it, to join, late in its process, the Broadcast Protection Discussion Group, BPDG, yet another acronym. This is a subcommittee of CPTWIG, the Copyright Protection Technology Working Group of the MPAA. Alphabet soup, of course. What BPDG was trying to do was to create a, quote, industry consensus, unquote, about how devices should manage digital television. What the MPAA wants is for every device that can decode a digital television signal to include in a bit that comes from the whatever show you're watching, and it has to respect that bit. It has to say, if this bit is on, I promise not to let anybody downstream from me copy this media. copy this technology. In fact, I will make sure that the users are frustrated if they try to copy it. I will make sure that that only certain devices will be allowed to even play it. There was a huge document written by this working group. And they claimed this working group was an open process that anybody was allowed to join. So I called the MPAA and said, we want to join the broadcast protection discussion group. In fact, we have a product called GNU Radio that's copyrighted by the Free Software Foundation. GNU Radio now has the facility to decode, if you have a pretty beefed up PC, a digital television signal. So you can, on your GNU Linux box, install GNU Radio, buy an antenna, get the HDTV signal, and watch it with various different viewing programs. So we actually have a product in this space that will be regulated by BPDG. So I said I wanted to join. They said, well, we don't know how you join that. You have to call the CPTWIC people. So I called the CPTWIC people. They didn't know how you were supposed to join. Fortunately, the Electronic Frontier Foundation had been posting a web log of all the activities of BPDG. I called my friends at EFF and said, we ought to join this. And they said, yeah, we've been a member. It'd be nice to have you there. So we joined late in the process. We were only around long enough for one of the conference calls. I got about a minute to say something about free software. It was totally, you know, on the other side, except for the Philips guys, who were a little bit on our side. The Philips guys were most worried about the fact that if you have all these devices that do all this various, you know, encoding and respecting this bit, what happens when a guy takes a video camera of his daughter and wants to mail it to his mom over the internet through various different devices? Shouldn't they have the right to do that? And the MPAA says they weren't all that worried about that. Philips felt, hey, if it's your content, you should be able to run it through as many devices as you want and not have it hampered in any way. But I got a piece in to say that, hey, look, we have a vested interest in this space. We are the copyright holders on this product. If you get this BPDG thing moving forward and you actually get it to Congress, which is what you're all saying you're going to do, this will effectively make our product illegal. Because under our distribution terms, under GNU GPL, we cannot add, quote, user frustrating, quote, provisions. In fact, we give the user the source code and allow them to modify it. That's not frustrating. That's giving them the means to help themselves. We can't add all these protections in, because even if we did, the user could modify to take them out. And they said, we'll certainly add your comments to our draft report. And at the end of the call, the guy from Fox Networks named Andy Sitos said, well, it sounds like we have general consensus about everything that we're going to do here. And I chimed in and said, I don't think we have general consensus. And the EFF guy says, we don't have general consensus. And the Philips guy says, we don't have general consensus. And Sitos said, well, even if we don't have consensus, we certainly have agreement. I looked the word consensus up in my dictionary using dict on my GNU Linux box. It's only one of the definitions is general agreement. How in the world could BPDG have general agreement but not consensus? I don't know, but Cedars thought we did. Fortunately, the BPDG process broke down. In the end, Philips signed on and said they didn't support it. EFF, of course, had a long list of reasons why they didn't support it, and their comments were attached. We endorsed the EFF thing that they had written and added a few comments of our own, which in fact weren't added, but we didn't quibble. At least the EFF one got in. And even in the end, Microsoft came out and said, this is not a consensus-based process, and we cannot endorse this recommendation. It is a strange day when the Free Software Foundation and Microsoft take the same position on an issue. It means something is really wrong. Now, the scary thing about all this is the alphabet soup. It's about the fact that I bet there's no one, or maybe a few people, looking at Michael, in this room who knew about all this. Yet they said it was a public process. In fact, they were banking on the fact that it was a public process, because when they go to Congress, they're going to say, we had a public process that decided this. Pay attention. Watch EFF's site. Watch our website. Get involved. We were fortunate enough to have the number for the conference call slash-dotted, at least on the Your Rights Online section, right before it was about to happen. EFF said, well, it's a public process. We'll post the phone number for the conference call. The conference call had about 13 people on it who were speaking, who had identified themselves. They called to the operator for the conference call, and she said, you have 50 lines dedicated, and they're all full. At one point, a Sony executive was saying, well, we'll just decide what we're going to do with this technology, and we'll sell it to the public. We're good at selling things to the public anyway. And some slashdotter chimed in saying, the public's actually already here, listening. This kind of process is what needs to happen. You need to call your legislators, pay attention. This big battle is coming. The MPAA wants to shut down free software, not because they particularly hate free software. I just heard Disney's using it for their rendering engines. But it's because they're afraid of what free software means, just like they were afraid of what VHS meant. They claimed VHS was going to be the death of the movie industry. In fact, VHS, I've heard, accounts for 60% of the movie industry's profits today. I'm sure DVD will be the same, even if you can play a DVD on your GNU Linux box and make a copy. I'm sure they will make lots of money anyway. I think the worst problem we have is, in fact, not all of this, though. What I'm most worried about is that this community that we have is going to forget its roots. I'm worried that we're going to go the open source route and forget that freedom was the reason all of this got started. I want everybody to enjoy free software and get excited about its technology and all the stuff it can do for you. But also, we need to act politically. And we need to take a stand, each individual ourselves, for a better world. If you're a user, I encourage you to reject proprietary software, even when it's zero cost here at the meeting. I encourage you to tell your distribution vendors that you don't want proprietary software projects on your otherwise free GNU Linux system. Many distributions give you 99% free software and 1% proprietary. In fact, they'll probably trick you by saying that 1% proprietary is value-added stuff we give you. That says something about their values. They value their profit and their ability to market to you more than your freedom. I hope you'll say to them, no, I don't want the freedom subtracted packages. I just want the free software. If you're looking for a GNU Linux distribution that has a good policy, good stringent policy about free software, I recommend the Debian GNU Linux system. That's what I run. If you use the official version, it's only free software. They do have a non-free area, but if you request only free software packages, you'll only get free software packages. And if you're a programmer, I hope you won't just take a job writing proprietary software because you're just dying to get a job doing programming. I hope you'll either find something else to do or find a way to make free money doing free software. If you absolutely have to say yes to that proprietary job, at least please send some of your paycheck to the Free Software Foundation to help us continue our work. We could really use it, I'm telling you. We're pretty bad off. And I hope that you'll look at computer science in a different way. I don't think it exists to maximize people's profit. It's really up to the next generation to show the world that the GNU GPL can be used to innovate and still make a comfortable living in the software industry in a way that values people's freedoms. I urge all of you to fight for a cooperative industry that respects freedom and profits not only the individuals doing the work, but society as a whole. I'm grateful for your time. I'm happy to take questions. Please do fill out a comment card before you leave. People who were trying to ask during the little break we had. So who had their hand up during the break? Did you have your hand up during the break?
No, but I...
Okay, we'll go with you first then.
You make just a little diversion on semantics. In French, I think it's Libre Té and Gratuit.
In French it is, right. In Spanish it's Libre and Gratuit.
Well, did anyone try to use some variation of liberty with regard to...
Yeah, I mean, it's always the adjective issue we come down to. So what's the adjective for liberty?
We've
had these discussions a number of times. I would call software liberated if it was proprietary software once and then it became free software. Like, I would say OpenOffice.org is liberated software because it was proprietary, now it's free. GNU Emacs has been free since the first line of code. It's really hard. When I talk about the concept as a whole, I tend to say software freedom. That's a very clear, unambiguous way of saying it. The software itself, there's unfortunately not a better term than free software or libre software, which I'll use if I think a crowd can handle it. Internationally, that's what I use all the time.
How about public?
Public has issues as well because the software right here is sort of public, right? You're getting it in a public place, from a public company, but it's not free, as in freedom.
freedom sounds
like? Yeah, well, that's a lunge of English, right? You're using a noun as an adjective. We've heard it all, and we haven't found a better word. I try to use software freedom as a phrase anywhere I can, and that helps. Yeah?
I wonder if you can give me a general idea of what are the differences between the GPL and the LGPL.
The GPL and the LGPL are different because of the way they talk about combining with other software programs. The lesser GPL, the LGPL, was invented as a trade-off for a specific circumstance. A circumstance where there's a library of code with a well-known API that's implemented everywhere in proprietary software. It was originally invented for the GNU C library, this implementation of the Unix-compatible C library for the GNU system. The reason the GNU project invented it was because they said, well, if we have this C library and we release it under GPL, it means under terms of GPL, any program you combine with this C library is required to be released as free software when it's distributed. That means that any application on a GNU or a GNU Linux system is required to be GPL because basically every application links against the C library. Now, so we thought about that for a minute. So, okay, well, that brings more free software to the world. That sounds like a good thing. And then you look at the other side of it. Well, there are lots of proprietary C library implementations, like everybody and their brother has one. So what would happen is some proprietary software vendor would say, we have a C library. Let's port it over to the GNU and the GNU Linux systems and sell it to people real cheap on a regular, divide and conquer proprietary licensing basis. We'll make millions because everybody wants to write proprietary applications for GNU Linux systems, especially now that they're popular, and we'll be able to license the library to them. We knew this was going to happen because there was, hundreds of C library implementations floating around. So if we released ours under the GPL, it basically would encourage more proprietary software. If we release it under lesser GPL, which allows the other company to link against it in a way that uses the library, but any changes to the library itself have to be made available under terms similar to the GPL. So what you find is lots of proprietary software for GNU Linux, but it links against free libraries under the lesser GPL. What does this mean for you as a user? Well, if there's a bug in the library, at least you can fix the library. Even if you can't fix the proprietary software itself, you can fix the library. And they're required to give you a mechanism to upgrade the library, either by using dynamic linking or by giving you the object code. Another thing that it requires is it requires that proprietary software allow you to reverse engineer it. So every proprietary application that is available on a GNU Linux system, if it links against the GNU C library, they're required to allow you to reverse engineer it and learn how to write a free software version of it. So there's lots of benefits from doing it that way, and the benefits in that case outweigh the benefits of maybe a few people would link against the GNU C library and be required, under GPL, and be required to make it free software. Now, if this is important to note here, that the reason it works out this way is because there were so many C library implementations. If your library is completely innovative, invented from scratch, and nobody's ever done something like this before, I would encourage you to GPL it. And this is the case with GNU Readline. When we released GNU Readline, there was nothing else like it available. And over the years, a number of proprietary programs have been faced with a choice. Either I don't provide Readline-like facilities because I can't get it anywhere else, or I make my software free software. Many of them have chosen to make it free software because they wanted to use Readline. They could always just not use Readline, but they wanted to so much that they were willing to make their software free software. So in that case, it's better to release the library under GPL. So does that explain the question?
Yeah. I've been involved with the free software.
Is this a separate question? I want to give everybody a turn.
Oh, okay.
So why don't I come back to you once a couple of people have asked?
I have two questions.
Well, ask one and then I'll come back to you.
What is the legality of the project of the principal times where the saying they're going to release it as GPL is when it's released, but they're going to be in the process of doing another release of course code?
Okay, well, there's two ways that process could work out. I'll talk about them separately. Process A would be somebody's written a new program, new system completely from scratch, and they're promising they're going to release it under GPL after beta. It's all their work. They hold all the copyright. In that case, they're just making a promise to you, and you hope that promise is valid. They have a right under copyright law to release it under any license they want. Now, if you can find a way that they were contractually obligated under what they said to release it under GPL later, then you can put pressure on them under contract law or fraud law and say, hey, you promised to release this as free software under GPL, and you haven't yet. When are you going to do that? So if it's your own copyright, you know, you are permitted to do that. You're permitted to license it in any way you want and in many different ways you want. Lots of people hold copyright on something, release one version under GPL, and release another version to someone else under a proprietary license. Now, that's the case where the person or the company holds all the copyright themselves. Now, let's consider case B. Case B is where they've taken some GPL work, they've modified it, and now they're distributing a derivative work of that GPL work to the public or to anyone. Each person who receives a copy of that distribution, be it an alpha, a beta, a gamma, a full release, whatever, the company is required to give that person's source code. Now, they're not required to give everybody the beta. They can pick and choose. I could say, I have a beta of this product, it's under GPL, but only you two guys are getting it. And I can give it to them. Of course, I'm required to give them the source code under terms compliant with GPL. Once they get it, they could turn around and say, everybody else in the room, come get your copies. And I can't stop them. But I can say, no, I only give it to those two. Nobody else. And they, of course, have freedom to distribute around as they like or choose not to. They might be stingy and say, no, we're going to keep it for ourselves. Which would be bad for them to do, but they have that legal right to do so. So you're probably asking this because of Lindos, aren't you?
Well, I've heard of a couple projects
it's one of these case B where there was a derivative work or something else.
I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, find out whether it's case A or it's case B. If it's case B, you should write to license-violation@gnu.org, and we will do what we can about it. We get a lot of violation reports. We can do something about it directly if we hold copyright on something in that work. So if it's, you know, a modified GNU program that we have the copyright on, we can directly act. If it's somebody else's copyright, we can indirectly act by talking to the copyright holder and helping them enforce the license. Does that answer your first question? Okay. Let me give a couple other people.
Summarize the questions.
Okay. I will summarize from now on. My apologies. Did you ask one yet? No. Okay. Go ahead.
I think we decided to hold off.
Oh, that's right. Yes. So you had the question about the trusted computing platform. Okay. So your question was, what is FSTEP's opinion on the trusted computing platform?
What your awareness is, what's been done. I'm kind of new. I'm newly exposed to this. So.
Yeah. Well, the trusted computing platform stuff is an idea that has been kicked around for I saw it first about 2 years ago, maybe. And then it sort of died, and it's come back in recent times. There was a Register article recently about it, that's probably what you've seen. This is a very scary thing, and I'll explain why it is so scary. Because under GPL, you can have a software that you distribute, and you can distribute other information with it. So you can distribute under GPL a copy of a GNU Linux system with a set of secured MD5 signed checksums of all the pieces of component of your operating system, a checksum of Galleon, of glibc, of Linux, and all the other pieces of the operating system. So Red Hat, for example, if they wanted to, could ship you the free software, the source code for the free software, and all these checksums. Now, suppose they started doing this. Suppose they started shipping these checksums. They could turn their distribution, their Red Hat distribution, into a, quote, trusted computer platform. But what's a trusted computer platform? That's something that the industry wants, primarily, again, the motion picture, the recording industries, and the publishing industries, as a way to stop people from infringing copyright, is the public reason they give. Mainly, they're trying to trample fair use in a variety of different ways, including stopping not just infringing copyright, but other things that should be fair use under copyright. So they want the ability, for example, to put an electronic book up on a website and know that if you download it onto your computer, that you won't be able to make another copy of it for a friend or download a song and not be able to make a copy, only be able to play it on that computer. Well, to do that, they have to trust your computer. They have to make that thing I was talking about, that leak-proof pipe, all the way from their website, all the way down to the lowest level of bits of code on your computer, all the way through web browser, through C library, through kernel. To do that, they have to have a way to authenticate it. Well, one way they can authenticate it is if it's all proprietary software, they can be pretty sure that it's safe. But even better, if they have these checksums that I'm talking about against the software, done in an encrypted way, and then some certification authority, I'm sorry if I'm getting too encryption crazy, if people have detailed questions about this encryption stuff, I can answer those. So the certification authority says, yes, indeed, this is a valid signature from Microsoft Corp, from Red Hat Corp, from whatever Corp, and you can trust this because I have signed it and made sure. As long as the binary on that system matches that checksum and it's trusted, you can trust it. And the binary is designed to do that. Now, if it's a Red Hat system, you can change your software. You can recompile Linux. You can recompile Galian. You can recompile all the GNU stuff and install a new version of the operating system. GPL gives you that freedom. Red Hat respected it by giving you the source code. However, you probably can't get this certification authority to certify your version, particularly if you added features that allowed you to save the music or copy it to another computer, right? So now you've got this uncertified, non-trusted platform, and you can't browse half the websites on the internet because they all require to access this site, it must be a trusted computer platform. We're not there yet. This is not the world yet. But if this becomes the world, what it won't do is it won't stop free software through legal means. It's not like it's illegal to have a free software trusted platform. In fact, somebody like Red Hat, I hope Red Hat wouldn't do this, I don't think they would, could go into the business of a trusted GNU Linux system because they put these checksums in. Yes, you get the source code, but if you recompile, you're not a trusted computer anymore. What they do is they will ghettoize all the users who choose to modify the software for themselves. They will not be able to access lots of websites. They will not be able to access lots of content. And they do it in a completely legal way, a way that doesn't violate the GPL, and a way that doesn't require any new legislation. It just becomes, quote-unquote, industry standard, and most websites start requiring it. It's terrifying. And I encourage all of you to post trusted computing platform stuff in any way that it comes at you. The best way you can do this is refuse to run them. If they come out, say, I'm not running one, encourage all your friends never to run one. Because the key thing about this, the scary thing about it is that it's just a de facto thing. It's not a legal system. But because it's a de facto thing, if everybody refuses to run it, then it won't get anywhere. That's the best way I know how to fight the trusted computer platform. Because there's really, you know, I had a call with our general counsel, Evan Moglen, and we spent about an hour and a half discussing this issue. And there was lots of long pauses because I just presented to, he was like, well, maybe we can do something like this. I said, what about this, this, and this? And he said, oh. And we went back and forth for a long time trying to figure out how we could solve it. Like, so suppose we can modify the GPL to say that you have to allow to be recertified. But that in itself is a restriction of freedom because you're saying you can't add certain features to the software and pass along with, deliver with the software certain encrypted data. You're restricting people from distributing certified binary signatures with the software. That, to me, seems like a restriction on freedom. I mean, I don't want to restrict people's freedom just to save their freedom. That's not right either. So it's a hard, hard, hard problem to solve. The best way to solve it is refuse. Refuse trusted computing platforms. Fine. Did you ask yet? No. No. Go ahead. That's all I hand over here. We'll get to that next.
I was just curious, with the BSD license and the GNU license, is it possible, let's say the FreeBSD guys come up with some real cool thing that could be useful with the GNU Linux system.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be possible for the GNU Linux system to incorporate some of that code under the BSD license?
Okay, the question, I'll just restate the question using his terms to get it to the tape. He's asking, he said, the quote, BSD license and the GNU license, and the quote, GNU license. Would it be possible if, say, the FreeBSD developers develop something interesting, can a GNU Linux system incorporate it? Now, to answer that question, I first have to define terms because the two terms you used are very ambiguous. You said BSD license, GNU license. There's a number of BSD licenses, there's a number of GNU licenses. And depending on the details, it plays out differently. I'll answer the question first for the most common of the two. So the modified BSD license, which is the BSD license, the original old BSD license, minus something called the advertising clause. The modified BSD license also goes under the name of X11 license, the X386 license. Today I saw it called the FreeBSD license, and so forth. But it's the key thing is the advertising clause is not there. The reason that's important is because without the advertising clause, the modified BSD license is compatible with the GNU GPL. What does it mean to be compatible with a license? It means that if you take software from place A and software from place B and put it together, you can distribute the result if and only if the licenses are compatible. So you have to make sure A and B have compatible licenses. Now, if you have an old BSD license with an advertising clause, you can't combine it with GPL software because the advertising clause places an additional restriction on the software that the GPL doesn't permit it. So if you take the two together, combine them into a work, and distribute them together, you're violating one license or the other, depending on the way you look at it. License compatibility is a big issue. It's very, very problematic in a practical way. It's not like the old BSD license really restricts your freedom. It requires that if you make a product that includes the work, in any advertising, you have to include the name of the person who wrote the work. There's some practical problems with that, namely that in modern BSD systems, if they still have the advertising clause, any advertisement about FreeBSD would have to be like 3 pages long to include all the names. And this is why eventually the advertising clause was abandoned. So it's not like that's a real restriction on freedom in any way that I've talked about here, but it just creates these practical problems that you can't combine A and B, which really is problematic for development. So that's the licensing issue. In most cases, all the FreeBSD stuff is under the modified BSD license. Absolutely, you could incorporate it in. And in fact, what you can do, when licenses are compatible, you can have a whole directory of source files, you know, A.C, B.C, C.C, and so forth, and each one can have a different license. And as long as all those licenses are compatible with each other, you can combine them in a compilation process into one big work, and everything's hunky-dory. No problems at all. Now, there's a technical issue there in what you asked, which is that the core of the operating system between GNU Linux and FreeBSD are very different. So it's actually really hard to just grab code right out of the lower levels of FreeBSD and port them over on a GNU Linux system, because that requires compatibility between the FreeBSD kernel and the kernel named Linux. Now, user space software, things like GNOME applications, which as you find on GNU Linux, most of them, a simple recompile, and they work on FreeBSD. Does that address that question?
Yeah,
okay, good. I saw a hand up over here while I was talking before.
Yeah, I guess about the trusted computing issue, which I guess really means that your computer doesn't trust you.
That's right.
So Hollywood can trust your computer.
That's right.
But would it really be possible to make a trusted computer with the software, which as long as there weren't laws that restricted your ability to change that software? Because granted, yes, you could change it, and it would no longer be certified.
Right.
But couldn't you also write a program, since you have the source code, you could also write a program that would receive whatever content it was, tell the content provider that, yes, you're dealing with a trusted computer, but handle it differently than the program was intended to.
Yeah, the question is,
as long as there was no law against that.
Yeah, to put this on the record, first you made an interesting point, which is a trusted computer platform means, at least the way that it's been defined in the industry so far, is that your computer doesn't trust you, but the MPAA trusts it, so it's kind of an ironic thing, which is the first point you made. Then the question was, you know, what are the technical details of making a trusted computing platform in the way the MPAA defines it with a free software system? I believe it's in fact possible with the right cryptographic foo in place. I haven't been through the details in my mind in clear enough that I could probably describe it off the cuff here. It's probably a better discussion over dinner, and I'm sort of wondering if I want to, like, in public form start describing how you would do it, because I hope people don't do it, right? But, I mean, there's basically cryptographic ways you could. I mean, the general idea probably would be that the program on the fly computes a checksum. If that checksum does not match the one that was shipped, signed by the certifying authority, the program refuses to do that. So you could possibly generate one that, you know, lies about that, but then there will be a certifying authority signature that then is conflicted with it. There's probably a lot of details to be worked out. I'm pretty convinced that it could be done, because with enough public and private key stuff going on, right, if you have, you know, for example, they could compile, there's probably a way to do it. I'm worried that somebody will find a way to do it, I think is what's going to happen. Do it in a very easy way, right? You can make a user space daemon that does the certifying. That piece is proprietary. And it won't certify anything that doesn't know about it.
That wouldn't be free software.
That wouldn't be free software. But the rest of the system could be, right? Every other component could be, except for this one little teeny daemon that all it does is tell me a binary in the system. I'll tell you if it's certified. That's all that daemon does. It can sit there and just answer those requests off a network. And that's a program you can write in like 100 lines, right? And that would be the only proprietary component in your system. All the other stuff's free software, but you got this one, and if it's not there, it means you can't use anything on the internet. Because your computer is no longer trusted. So, there's probably other cryptographic ways that are more clever.
There might be ways that you could spoof that.
Yeah, look, I hope people spend a lot, if trusted computing becomes a popular thing, I hope people do, as you say, find lots of ways to spoof it and basically make it a mockery of itself. And hopefully it'll die the death it deserves.
My point is, though, if that's true, what I'm saying is right, but if it is right, then the problem really becomes not trusted computing per se, or the idea of them trying to certification signatures, but that there might be laws that they... In effect, like EMCA, the problem isn't really the technology, the problem is really...
Yeah, and that's the case with CBTPA, that's the case with BPDG and CBTWIG and all these alphabet soup I've been talking about. The problem is, in fact, that the laws will try to enforce this, that copyright laws will not be copyright laws anymore, they'll be technology control laws. And the reason I think that's an easier fight is because we still do have a system that, you know, this is all Chomsky and stuff, right? But we have a system that if we can get around the food that's put out and the garbage that's put out by the mainstream media and actually fight back, we have access to our system. We don't have a dictatorship yet. So we can write our legislators. And if people scream enough people scream, and you tell your mother and your brother and your sister and your dog and anybody you can meet about these issues, eventually there can be a groundswell of support. And other countries are actually more hopeful because a lot of other countries have a much more democratic process than we do, believe it or not. But that's not the opinion of the FSF, that's my personal opinion.
My point is that it's going to be, even though it's already very difficult, we're going to have a difficult time holding back these negative laws, but that's going to be easier for us than to try to force the government to pass positive laws if that became necessary.
I do want to move on to other people, but on that point, what you're saying about, you know, it's we have to stop the evil laws, how in the world could we pass positive laws for free software? I think honestly, there's no chance of getting positive free software laws passed in the United States. They're going to happen in South America. They're going to happen in France. They're going to happen in Germany. The future of free software may be outside the U.S. I mean, there's a good chance it is. But I think we have a very good chance in at least ending it here, and probably we have a reasonably good chance of getting DMCA repealed. That's all we're hoping for. I mean, that's the best bet given the current political climate. All right, I want to move on to other. I'm happy to talk more about this at lunch.
I'm changing batteries. Take the question.
Go ahead. Yeah. That's another side too. I mean, the industry doesn't know how they're going to do it yet, and they're going to come out with things like that. We'll put it in hardware and software in some combination.
And then are we going to mod our computer so we can run what we want on it in that respect?
Yeah, I mean, probably that's the case. I mean, look, I'm no expert on trustless platforms. I don't think anybody is because the industry itself does not know how it's going to do it, whether it's going to be a software-hardware combination and so forth. The only thing we do know is that they want to make sure there's a way to make a 99% free software system a quote trusted platform, which will in effect decimate your ability to make use of your freedoms under things like
it's not your computer anymore.
So it's suddenly not your computer. So I don't want to spend too much time on trusted platform because probably other questions. Is this a trusted platform thing? No, good. Go ahead. Okay. And then we'll swing back around to the people who have second questions.
This is one question, but there's two parts.
Okay. He always says this, too.
No.
Go ahead, Michael.
You talked about as if one has a choice in getting a job between working in proprietary software and working in free software. But the vast majority of jobs in computers are neither. They're working for in-house software.
That's sort of the gray area, right? When you're working on software that is... So his question was for the same.
So part one is that there's no software that isn't being marketed. It's not being developed to be sold.
Right. There's lots of software, as Point is banking, that's developed in-house. It's never distributed to anyone. So it's really neither proprietary nor free software. It just is. It's like software you've just written, right? I've just typed in a couple lines of code on my computer. It's not really free nor proprietary yet. It's only on my computer. So I haven't decided how it's going to be distributed yet. So, yes, I think you're right. That's true. The way I look at it is this way. If the software that you're developing custom in-house is in any way possibly generally useful to the world, the ethical thing to do is distribute it to the world. If it's so in-house, you know, my script that, you know, does the weird things to tunnel my email through SSH. I've actually emailed these scripts to people if you want them. I don't know why you want them because I'm insane, but perhaps you want them, and I do distribute them. But I haven't released this free software because it's so hacked together and it's really specific to my account. If it's really that custom software that's so specific to you personally that nobody could really benefit from it, well, what's the point? But if it is custom software that could be generally useful, I think companies should really try to get it out there as free software. I think the ethical issue is a little bit more gray. I agree with you. All ethical issues are not black and white. They're always shades of gray. But I think that if you're choosing between the three, proprietary, in-house, and free, I choose the free. If you're choosing proprietary and in-house, obviously you're right. Choose in-house first. But that has a subtle effect where you're right. You spend your life writing software that could be generally useful, and they won't let you release it to the world. That would grate on me just as much as writing proprietary software. I'll get back to that. There's a lot of people who are stuck in.
I just want to comment. And,
okay.
Right. Let them comment, and I'll get to the second
part. Come on. Other people have been waiting for their second question for a while. But give your second part because you set it up front.
All right. So the second part is also you mentioned about Microsoft is changing Kerberos and not giving back,
mm-hmm.
Not giving back to the community.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of giving back to the community, I just want to make it clear because we're getting a lot of FUD, or fear, uncertainty, doubt about this, where the free software and the copyleft is being accused of forcing people to have to give things, to have to make public disclosure of everything they all derivative works. And you clearly have the right to take a free software program and make your own version of it for your own use. The arguments we're having is about things that you're marketing to sell.
That's right.
You always have the right to make your own, but we're being attacked as if you didn't.
And Michael's quite correct. His point is that, for the tape, is that Microsoft will tell you, and other proprietary software companies will say, well, if you touch that GPL stuff, that could say, if even it comes like within 100 feet of your computer, all of a sudden you're required to do all these things. Now, first of all, you know, it's required by the GPL that you make it prominent that the software is copyrighted under terms of GPL. So there's not lots of people downloading GPL software and being surprised. How could I know this was GPL? I mean, it's required by the license that you make it prominent. So the chance of accidentally getting for GPL software into a system is basically non-existent. You have to have an engineer who commits gross negligence to have that happen, who just says, I didn't even pay attention to what I was downloading. I closed my eyes, downloaded it, and it was suddenly there, and I kept my eyes closed the whole time I was writing. So there's that issue.
That's how you agree to a EULA.
Yeah. I encourage people not to do that.
And you've agreed to something.
So, another point on GPL agreement, I'm going to do next because you've been waiting patiently for your second question. The other thing about GPL is most people, probably about 80 or 85% of people who have gotten GPL software never, ever, ever agreed to the license. You only agree to the GPL if you undertake activities covered by copyright law. Copying, modifying, and redistributing. So if you don't do any of those things, if you downloaded it, you copied it from some web server to your machine, the person who has obligations for copying is the guy on that web server. Once you got your copy, if you never copy it for somebody else, if you never distribute it, if you never modify it, you haven't agreed to the GPL. You can delete all the software from your computer, and it's as if you never even had GPL software in your system. So that's point two. Point three is what Michael was getting to most directly. Michael was saying that there's lots of times you can modify the software but not distribute it. And in fact, that's right. There are three separate activities: copying, modifying, and distributing. And of course, there's the combination of modifying then distributing. But if you just modify, your obligations under GPL are different than if you modify and distribute. Microsoft and other proprietary companies that are spreading this confusion are pretending like they're the same thing. That the minute you download it and modify it, all of a sudden you have to give your changes off to the world. In fact, you never have to. On the train this morning, I was modifying a GPL package. I was actually going through and commenting out code to make it work. This seems to be a theme in my life. It needed MySQL, but I decided it didn't need, so I commented out everything that said MySQL, and it worked. Sorry. But, you know, I'm probably never going to distribute that, because does anybody really need my patches to comment out the MySQL stuff that's really supposed to be there anyway? Of course not. I'm never going to distribute it, ever. So I've modified. Under GPL, I've agreed to GPL, and I have obligations under modification. I had to make, you know, my changes prominent and yada, 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 which I did. So it's clear that I've done the right thing under GPL, but it doesn't mean I have to give you a copy. If you walk up to me and say, I want those patches to that program that take out the MySQL stuff, I can say no. I have the right to say no under GPL. And in fact, any company can do that. If they've taken software in-house, modified it, and somebody else comes and says, I heard you're using GPL in-house, give me all your modifications, they can say no. And they're allowed to do that under GPL. So I think that clarifies all the points. Let me get to this guy. He's so patient waiting for a second question.
How often has the GPL been changed or updated?
The GPL has been changed twice. That's not really true. It's been changed once. There was a beta of the GPL, which was the various different public licenses. There was, in the early days, back in like 84 or 85 through 87, 88 or so, there was the Emacs public license and the GCC public license and various others. The reason it's called general public license is because it generalized. We were writing public licenses for each program, which is kind of silly, so it was generalized into one license, which is why it's called the general public license. That was written in version 1, 1989.
You never had to update it.
No, it's been updated once. It was updated in 1991. And those changes reflected various things that were found to be a little buggy in the first version. Now, we have been working for a while on GPL version 3. Now, the issue, the reason it needs to be updated, is because you can only see so far ahead in what's happening in the technology world. I mean, you can see a couple years ahead, right? You can see where the things are going. But you can't see 10 years ahead, certainly. And there are things going on in the world now with software, mainly, you know, web interfaces to things, that nobody could have really foreseen. Nobody could have foreseen things like, you know, a application that ran on a website and you used it that way back in 1991. The web was brand new. So GPL does not address this issue. There is a beta of GPL v3 out, or really an alpha, and it's under the name of a Faro General Public License. A company called Faro was worried about this issue, this web services issue. And we had drafts of GPL v3 circling around internally, and we gave them a modified GPL version 2 that includes some provisions for web services. And that's available, and you can look at our site, which links to a Faro site, and look at how it's coming about. We're still working on GPL v3. The problem is the foremost expert on GPL, and probably the only person who has the deep understanding you need of copyright law and GPL and free software and technology to do the job of helping us write GPL v3 is our general counsel, Evan Moglen, who has a bazillion other duties, including being a professor here at Columbia Law School. I've heard his classes are open to the public, so find out when his classes are and go to them. He told me that he lets anybody come to his classes. So you guys have a real benefit. Go to every class Evan teaches. It'll be worth your while, I'm sure. So, and he's also teaching in Holland this summer, and so we need his expertise, and we're slowly getting that to get GPL v3 out the door. I'll get to you next. Yeah, you in the black shirt had a second question.
Yeah. Comment on your stuff that you were talking about before. Microsoft was saying that they don't allow programmers because it's like PAM native. That's my comment on it. Second question was you were talking about non-disclosure agreement. What are the implications or something you have to keep in mind in order to have a GPL project that can it not even have a non-disclosure agreement?
Well, there are various types of non-disclosure, right? So you could say, I promise not to disclose that, you know, this company is planning to launch a product based on this GNU GPL program. I mean, that's probably a non-disclosure agreement you could sign, depending on the details, because all you're saying is I promise not to talk about, product plans, which are not technology. Basically, any non-disclosure agreement that covers generally useful technical information related to the program is probably incompatible with GPL. By the way, for the sake of the question was, you know, what about non-disclosure agreements? Are any of them okay? It depends on the details. I encourage you to talk to the to your employer, whoever's asking you to sign it, about what GPL work you're doing, about, you know, that sort of thing. Okay, why don't we talk offline about it? I'll try to help you do something and see if you can make it.
I've got a question.
Well, you're a first time. Is there any other first timers? Let me get them queued up. So you're next. So go ahead, Jolly.
Just media formats. How's OGBorbis going? There's this recent news that BP3 is, you know, come on as a video format.
Yeah, I've heard about BP3. I don't know much about it or how good it is or all that sort of thing. I know that there is a plan that it's going to be
The Creative Commons and the license for people to release you know, media content to the general public. Have you worked any on a license for that?
You're talking about releasing
and formats and licenses.
Okay, so first of all, the format issue. OGBorbis is a wonderful format. I am told by the people who are clueful about these things that it's better than MP3 anyway. It has more flexibility, so you have more choices between how high quality you want. The quality versus space trade-off is better. There'll be more choices for you. I'm told it compresses just as well as MP3. MP3 is encumbered by patents. So in the United States and many other countries, you are forbidden from writing a free software encoder that can encode the MP3 format because you need a patent license. And the only patent license they're offering is incompatible with GPL. I encourage you to use OGBorbis, even if you're using proprietary systems. Basically, as far as I've heard, every proprietary player that's popular has a plugin for OGBorbis now. I've heard that the Mac has some troubles, but most of them do.
How do you spell that?
So OGG is the first word, OG. /, and then Vorbis, VORBIS. They're also working on something called OG Torkin, which is going to be their video codec. There is, as he mentioned, another video codec that has apparently been released and is in patent unencumbered, although I don't know much about it, so I'm not the guy to ask for the details. I hope to find them.
I think it was originally patented, and they threw in the towel.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's what I heard as well. So there is some video codec, so some hope on the video codec horizon. Now, as far as licenses for content, you know, releasing content under things like copyleft, a lot of people try this. We have the free documentation license, which is designed primarily for technical materials or other educational materials. So we have that. That's for books and other things, you know, written works that are educational materials. But there's, you know, a lot of strange issues, and in fact, it's a whole other topic to talk about the way to license various different types of work. I think in general, copyright is sort of this blunt instrument that is being applied to so many different types of works that are very, very different in the details. Computer software is fundamentally different from novels, is somewhat different from music, and certainly very different from computer software and so forth. I think what we need in this society, and this is all I can basically have time to say on this, is a real debate about how copyright law should be applied. Copyright law, at least in the United States, exists because of a line in the Constitution that says Congress shall have the power to create a copyright and patent system if it is deemed useful for the progress of science and the useful arts. A couple of key points
for a limited time.
For a limited time.
Right. And it's for so authors and inventors.
Okay, guys, these guys know this as much or if not better than I do. But I have my laptop. Actually has a constitution. I have this, you know, it's easy to get to if people want the exact quote. But the key points there are is that Congress doesn't have to make a copyright patent system. It's their option to make one. They have to be for a limited time. It's a limited time monopoly, control over that creative work. The framers wanted copyright and patent to feed the public domain. So you got some control over the idea for a while, just enough time to recoup your cost of developing the idea, and then it was supposed to go to the public good. And it should only be created, according to our Constitution, if it's deemed useful to promote science and the arts. I think we need a real debate in this society about what limited times are reasonable for various different types of works. In fact, we don't really have limited time because Disney keeps buying extensions on copyright. Perpetual copyright on the installment plan has been called. We have to have a debate about what types of copyrights promote science and art. how should copyright work to do that promotion? That should be the debate. Is this implementation of copyright law that we have promoting science and art in various different ways when you talk about it? So you're out of paper.
Oh, well. That's about it.
Okay. Well,
10 seconds to say thank you.
Okay, thanks for taking the tape, and I'll have to take more questions. I don't know if we have to go to the restaurant or not. I'm happy to continue to take questions at the restaurant.
The audio will still run for 15.
The audio will still run for 15 minutes. Now, one thing I have to note, one quick thing. If you have an unfriendly question, I require that you not ask it at dinner. So if anybody has any sort of unfriendly questions they want to ask, attack questions, I am absolutely happy to take them. I'm not against taking attack questions. I'm only against taking them over dinner. The reason I invented this rule was because as I was giving speeches around the country, people would sandbag me at dinner. You know, so we sit down, I'll sit down at dinner, and somebody look at me and say, so why is it you want programmers never to make a living again? You know, and I think that's just unfair over dinner. So is there any unfriendly questions? Do you have an unfriendly question?
I don't know. It's more provocative than it's...
Okay, go ahead.
Because I have studied about this. Intellectual property. You started this off saying that you wanted to give away copies of the game, or somebody to give away copies of the game that was bought, and you think we should distribute it to the prison.
No, not necessarily, right?
That's your original thinking.
Well, I mean, that was also my thinking at 10 years old.
Yeah.
My thinking has developed a little bit since then, as it turns out.
Yeah.
But the point there is that what we should create is a new community where people don't need to be put in the position between obeying a license and doing a good thing. I think that person I was talking about, Evelyn, was put in a situation where it probably seemed like a good thing to help a kid out and give him a copy of a program, but she agreed to something and said she wasn't allowed to do that. So she was in this dilemma. What I'm trying to build the world in is a dilemma.
It wasn't hers to give out.
Well, the question is, that's an interesting question, right? Who should own copyrighted works? Should works like that have owners? Now, the framers of our Constitution had a clear idea in mind. What they wanted is to give people certain limited time controls to recoup their costs. So let me finish making my point.
If
you're not going to let me answer the question.
But you're changing the basic premise.
No, I'm not.
The idea is that this work was created under the existing copyright system. Everybody's aware of it, be aware of it, and they agree to it. If they decide to produce something with the expectation they will have this protection, that they will be able to market it.
Okay, I see your point now.
And
I give that example of 10 to show my thinking and how it developed. I certainly don't infringe copyright myself. I don't run any proprietary programs. And one of the reasons that I don't use proprietary software is I don't want to be put in that ethical dilemma of choosing when you come and ask me for a copy, of giving you a copy or obeying the license I agreed to. The reason that what we're doing with free software is we're creating a shared commons where you do, under the existing copyright system, have the permission to do the things I'm talking about. So we're not out here saying, go get Microsoft Word and give everybody a copy. I don't tell you to do that. I don't think you should do that. What I say is, go get a GNU Linux system, a copy of Abbey Word and OpenOffice, and give everybody copies because you're allowed to. I'm saying, give up this proprietary stuff that doesn't allow you to copy. Say, I don't want to do that show anymore, and choose a different show where people are allowed to share. That's what I'm talking about.
What about games?
Games are an interesting issue. Certainly, there's lots of free software games, and I play them, although I shouldn't, because I don't have time for it. But games are an interesting issue because you have this model where most of the money with games is made in the first year. And the other thing about games is that they aren't necessary to get a particular job done on a computer. So if you have a game, it's not like you need the game to do your work. Nobody really does work with games.
Same with DVD movies and...
Well, I mean, I can certainly get an educational... What if my educational video that I need for my job comes on DVD? That's a very different issue. Games are one case where the only thing that a game can be is pure entertainment. And in that case, we have to look at it. Now, I wouldn't play a proprietary game, but on the other hand, I think it's reasonable for game companies to do what its software does, whereas after 1 year, when they recoup their cost and made tons of money, they release the game under GPL 1 year later. That 1 year delay makes perfect sense for games.
Well, do they expect the Army has a game out that's supposed to help with recruitment, And I believe...
Well, then... Well, then that's not, it's not just the game. It's a training program that can act as a game.
Okay.
I mean, I think you're constructing a straw man. I mean, it's...
I'm just exploring the...
I think pure entertainment devices are a very different thing. Things that can only possibly be used for entertainment, which are games. A game can only be used for entertainment if it's if some generally useful technical things can be used as entertainment, but they're not there primarily for that. I think programming is entertaining.
So movies and music are which category?
I think movies and music are both sometimes. Some music is just pure entertainment and has no redeeming social value, like Britney Spears, for example. And some music is fundamental to our culture, like Mozart, like those sort of things, that is part of learning about our world. So they have multiple things. The discussion of how copyright should affect various different works is an important debate. We don't have time to have that debate now. I think our society should be having this debate. I'm glad we're having this discussion. Most people aren't discussing it. What most people are saying is what you started out by saying, copyright system is the way it is, it should be the way it is, let's leave it the way it is.
The way it is, and as long as you're dealing with it, and that's the way it is. You want to change it, that's something else.
Well, we're not having that debate in this society about changing it. And that's what I'm trying to talk about. And we don't need it either, because we can take the copyright system and turn it on its head through free software, where you have the freedom to do these things.